First of all, thank you everybody for coming.
Do that again.
I met George Clayton Johnson in 1972 at the World Times when I was 19. I did not know he was a famous writer for a year later. Humility, you know, never brought it up. And if George was here, I think the first thing he would say is, sure, it's a deal, one of his popular phrases. Or he'd be chanting because of the acoustics. This panel is from a totally different perspective. Everyone on this panel has had a close relationship with George for over 40 years and a relationship with Comic-Con. I started going to Comic-Con in 72 and I was a contributor to the film program. Scott Smith is the man who created the Comic-Con TV channel. He was on the Comic-Con committee in the 70s. He's the one in the early 70s that hacked the Otel TV system, and in the morning you'd be watching Godzilla, Fantasia and King Kong on your Otel TV before Otels had a pay TV channel system. And I helped him.
You're just going to climb the El Cortez Hotel if the outside you're on the wire.
Right, El Cortez. And yeah, Clayton climbed to the roof to hook up the cables. Then we have Clayton Moore, former committee member, artist, writer, and on the school board now in Victorville. He's known George for 40 years and has a close relationship with the Comic-Con as well. Then we have world-famous Disney legend, too humble guy, Floyd Norman, Disney animator. Floyd was the first African-American to walk hard.
Is the mic on?
Okay.
Just be far away from it. Yes.
Now my wife's there.
There you go.
Sorry. Floyd was the first African-American that Walt hired, and he worked on the spaghetti scene, Lady the Tramp with Willie Ito.
Can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Floyd came to Comic-Con El Cortez in the 1970s as a fan. Just bought his membership. He never told anybody you were an animator or wearing any panels. He just came and hung out in the 70s after he worked with Walt on and off for several years. And he's got some good George stories. Now we have Jimmy Dix. He's the exception to the rule. He has 26 years friendship with George and Comic-Con associationship. We call him the Jackie Robinson of Star Trek. He wrote After Next Gen, a lot of other episodes for all the different Star Trek franchises. And speaking of Star Trek, I have to apologize. David Gerald couldn't make it. He was coming to Comic-Con yesterday morning and got hung up. Same hotel as me, and his friend had to change his reservations. He will not be here till tomorrow. Next, we have Craig Miller. Craig Miller's known George since the 60s or 70s, Craig?
Probably the early 70s, I guess.
And he worked on that film with him. What was that called?
Star Wars?
Right. No, the film with George.
Oh, the film with George. Oh, there was an amateur movie made called The Night Turkey, which was a parody of The Night Stalker.
And it's still on YouTube, right?
I hope not.
I've seen it twice, and George and Craig's acting was over the top.
And yeah, I guess that's a good description.
Then we have Anthony Keith, former Comic-Con security and then director of security. I met him, I think, when he was 12 or 13. He's had a close relationship with George. We had George at his home several years ago, and he showed George the Blu-ray.
Wait, that's my story.
Right, he'll tell you the details on that later. And we had a lot of fun with George because we had the Sheldor fan club going, and George would be the first one at all the events. We did over 140 Sheldorf Awards, and George literally signed everyone to honor everybody. George was always there like a bullet to honor people. Last but not least, we got Gene Henderson. Gene has been to every single Comic-Con since 1970. He retired from the Comic-Con Board of Directors last year. Gene was also Director of Security for several years, and we love him. How can you not love the Hendersons?
This is con history, truly, right here.
So we're going to talk for almost an hour, then we're going to have the audience participate with questions and, you know, pay their respects about good stories. So first, let's go to Craig.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, I wasn't quite prepared. Yeah, I've known George since probably 1970 or so through Comic-Con, but also lots of science fiction conventions and just other events. And George was both amazing and unique. There was one Comic-Con party probably 30-plus years ago where George invited a lot of people up to his room for a party and then disappeared. And he came back in through the window.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he was naked. And he had gone to the wrong... He had also gone to the wrong room, which was someone who threw the window of someone not with the convention, who was a little startled to see this really skinny guy with long hair and a beard come naked through their window. But it worked out okay. Then George came next door to where we were, dumped a bunch of pot on the table and said... He had to go somewhere else, but we should all enjoy ourselves. That was kind of George.
Yeah. You know, George's long hair and beard. You remember the Howard Hughes thing in 78, 79 that showed those pictures? I'm like, all those shows? George comes to me and says, look great. I don't have a beard, but if I never cut my hair and grow a beard, I'll look the same age 30 years from now, will I? I said, yeah, why not? Scott Smith there on the end interviewed George several times in the early 70s, correct?
Yeah.
Many pictures and a couple of videos?
Yeah.
Go for it.
But I think at least one thing I'm going to share is it's the year that Timothy Leary came to the convention. Because we had already been doing live con TV. We were actually, I think it was the first year we managed to go a full 24/7 where I'd stay up or he'd stay up and we would just keep loading whatever people brought us. George would always bring things for us to show, by the way. Sometimes things that hadn't even been put on the air yet or released yet or just weren't going to be shown. But we put pretty much anything he'd drop off on the air and we'd interview him every year. So this one year, he agreed to come and we had someone else had brought Timothy Leary. So we got the two of them in the same room on the live TV going out to the hotel. And a whole bunch of teenagers in the convention were there watching. And they started talking about the future and what each one's vision of the future was. And then they started getting more and more radical because each one was trying to outdo the other one for what the future would look like. Well, it's going to look, you know, like the script I wrote for this. No, it's going to look like that. It's going to look like... And then it just kept getting more outrageous. And then... Well, Timothy Leary was a big proponent of alternative lifestyles and things that you don't smoke. George was a proponent of things you did smoke. And the two of them started passing things around to me. This was around the same time Timothy Leary released his book, What Do Women Want? So then we got into that for a discussion of, well, you know, was that book garbage or was the book really worth something? George had his own opinion. Timothy, of course, wrote the book, so he had his... George wasn't very impressed at the time.
But, I think we're giving the wrong impression that George was just about drugs.
Oh, no.
He was a really smart guy. And one time we had a panel up in L.A. at a convention called LostCon. And it was a science panel. And George was on it, and Jerry Pournelle, who some of you may know who Jerry is, science fiction writer and very active in the space program, and other people were on it. And Jerry is always very sure of himself.
Absolutely.
But George had actually researched the topic before the convention, and George kept saying things on the panel, and Jerry would say, "Really?" And George would have the sites, and he would know exactly. And he was just more up on it than the people who thought they were experts in it, because he'd actually looked into the topic. But he was a really smart guy, as well as being really into drugs.
And I'm not saying it was all about the drugs. It was the same thing where they were battling with, you know, who's got a better alternative future, who's got a better alternative reality. Is basically what was going on. So, you know, it was a constant battle between the two of them on every topic, everything. And it ended up being some of the best, I think, live TV we ever did.
Yeah, don't forget, George, in the early 70s, was a big cannabis advocate, and a science fiction writer predicting the future. He says, you know, 30, 40 years, this is going to be legal. This can't keep going on like this. Clayton? Clayton, jump in. You've got some good stories.
Well, okay. Good evening, everybody, and thank you all for coming tonight. Because it is kind of late. But, you know, George is up late, too. I've been coming to Calvin College since 1972. In fact, I think I just live here and visit the outside world. And George is the same way. He was here most every year. In good health or bad health or whatever state he was in, he was here. And he always had something that was valuable to contribute. I mean, I was a very young kid at the time. I was in high school. And when I knew George late at night, I'd come into a hotel room and he'd be in there, and all the other adults and people of every age would be friendly and nice to each other like they are now. And we interviewed him on TV a couple of times. In conversations, he was, like this gentleman said, a very smart guy. But he wouldn't stay on the topic during the detail. I mean, he would insert this one for a while, and then he'd go on that one, and bounce around. And there was an occasion after the passing of Sheldon Dorff, as a group of us went to see him, and then we came down to do a reminiscence after Sheldon passed. Great film part of it, put it on the internet. And one of those visits, I got to drive him down. And he lived in near LA. And I'd pick him up in LA and drive him to San Diego. And I would drive very fast and get the speed limit. And so we had time to talk. And he knew, again, I'm a high school teacher now, and somebody said I'm on the Board of Education, and that's true. And so I understand public education, and George didn't do public education. In his day, when he was young, he didn't dig school at all. Nothing about it appealed to him. And so he went another way. He went his own way. He talked about his career when he was a draftsman, architect, with some illustration work he was doing. That's the kind of work my dad did. My father's a commercial artist. And in the 50s, early 60s, he was in advertising in San Francisco, and George was somewhere out here doing similar work, but he wasn't engaged with it. He could do it, didn't like it. He wrote, he became a writer. And he started his writing career. And his writing career, he was his own boss. And he lived his life that way. And he would come to Comic-Con and support Comic-Con, like Jack Kirby and Ray Bradbury and many of the other early people who helped establish our convention. And his network of caring about people was an example, as a mentor, to many of us. You know, not directly setting out to be a mentor, you just do it. And he wrote an episode of Kung Fu. And that impressed me as a kid, because I like karate and everything. He wrote a Kung Fu one. He wrote the Star Trek episode of Happy Ornament for it. First Star Trek episode they showed. He did these landmark things, but he wasn't interested in that. He was interested in things that are happening in the world, in life. Things that inspire a writer. You know, he called himself in the car ride down. You know, he was like Daffy Duck. This is his description, not mine. He said he was that little black duck that nobody could tell him what to do. And he told that story like five different times over the weekend. You know, he was just, you know, anybody of any age, you would treat him the same. Treat him the same. So, those are some of my memories about George.
Cool, Clayton. George, what I said for years, and he kind of told me, but I figured I've been saying this on Facebook, I got this common mantra. If you want to be George's friend, never call him Uncle Pop or Mentor. Like Ray Bradbury and others, just so generous, helping people, mentoring, and never wanting anything in return. Most people can't do that. Now, Jimmy, you met George in 90 what? Or 80s?
I met George on my very first Comic-Con, 1990. He's one of the first people I ever met, he and Larry Niven. And I know he said he wouldn't like to be called mentor, but from that very first meeting, he actually became a mentor to me. And long before I ever did anything for Star Trek. And so I didn't even know who he was. I knew who Larry Niven was very well, but I didn't know any George Krebs. He was just a cool guy who befriended me at Comic-Con on the first year I was there. And then on the second year, this is back before, there were any black people coming to Comic-Con. I was the only spot of color in the whole convention. I would look from one end of the con to the other. I wouldn't see nobody. And then one day on my second year, I looked all the way down the hall, and I thought I saw this brother, and I started running toward him. Okay? And then I got halfway to him before I realized it was my own reflection in the glass. Okay? And I was standing there just all dejected, and this hand went. And it was George, and, you know, it's going to be okay, man. It's going to be okay. Whatever's got you now, it's going to be okay. You know? I thought he would have offered me a joint, but he didn't. And so there was a year after that that I sent a spec script to the producer Renegade. You guys remember when they were filming Renegade down there?
Yeah.
That producer fired off that script to Paramount. They hired me as a WG intern on Next Gen. And on my very first pitch, I sold. And the next Comic-Con, I was so happy. You know, I met George, who was just that cool white dude with all the hair, you know. And I told him, you know, hey, man, I did an internship at Paramount, and I sold my first Star Trek episode. And that's when I found out what he'd done. That's when I found out about the first episode. And I was, you know, never said anything about what he had done. And then when I found out about Logan's Run and, you know, Ocean's 11, you know, I practically got on my knees and started, you know, praying to him, you know what I mean? And he was just, from that moment on, you know, every word that dropped out of his mouth was like manna from heaven to me, you know? And I just tried to soak up as much of him as I can. And I like to think that, you know, I sold 9 episodes in total of Star Trek, and I like to think that his fingerprints are on all of them. That's my George story.
Cool. In 2009, October, when George and I, Mike Tardy, the late Richard Alf, William Fawcett, and Clayton Moore, we all started the Sheldor Fan Club, I said, George, we're going to visit him in the hospital. He's kind of in a diabetic coma. We don't know if he can communicate. And George says, I don't do hospitals. Well, George came along. We went in 2x2. We had to gown up in gowns, gloves, and masks. And the last two went in was, William, you went in with Richard, right? And you went in with George.
Yeah.
And he couldn't communicate. When I went in with Clayton, he just stared at us. And George said, we made membership badges, Sheldor Fan Club. We made one for, it said, our founder, Sheldor, and the El Cortez in the background. And Shell looked at Jordan and took it out of his hand, right, William? Is that how the story was?
What was the last part?
Shell actually took the badge out of George's hand. He kind of woke up when George gave it to him, right? That's what George told me.
Actually, the last time we saw him, he was totally unresponsive. The time before that, he was up. Remember, Clayton? We were watching TV with him.
Well, I've been there several times. But, yeah, I mean, he had different stages.
Over there, there's the handout cards I made for the panel. There's a picture I took of George at a birthday party a few years ago where they gave him this really professor hat. George would always say, Greg, you and I have PhDs in fandom. George would go to a few science fiction conventions in the 50s, and he told me that, wait, if I'm a famous writer, it'll help me be a bigger fan in fandom. He worked for HLEO, a military contractor, as a draftsman in the 50s. I worked for them in the 80s. He sold to MGM in the 60s. I worked for MGM a couple summers in the 70s. There's all these bizarre coincidences. But the most unique thing about him is that, he wrote pretty much one episode for all the great TV shows. Sunset Strip, Honey West, and he was just about perfection. Kung Fu Demon God is my favorite. In the 70s in Westwood Village, Rascal's restaurant upstairs, George had a writer's group for several years on Thursdays. Kung Fu pre-sold it. He just wanted it and he sold it to him. And he was there showing us, teaching us when he was writing it. Ed Spielman told me, the producer of Kung Fu, that David Carradine always wanted to direct it. He couldn't figure this out. He goes, here, David, you try to do it. And David directed it, perfect. George and him met a couple of times. He didn't change a word, they loved it. Most of the stuff George wrote is about cheating death. When the media said George died on the 22nd, Paul Johnson and I on Facebook, we left it alone. People are trying to correct it. George told me and Wendy all a year earlier he wanted to go on Christmas Day. But I had forgot that was also Rod Serling's birthday. So there you are. He planned his departure the best he could. And it's an amazing life story. And Anthony, when we were doing all our events and get-togethers with George, Anthony was always involved. He's got some great stories as well.
I don't know, Chris. Are you on it? Hello, now it's working. There we go. All right. Yes, hello. I have a couple of stories that I will tell. I don't want to take too much time, but I want to see if I got my money's worth here. But just so anybody that's unaware knows what this is from an episode that George, it's actually the very first episode of Star Trek that was shown on TV, and it's called Man Trap. And let's see if this works. Let's test this out real quick.
The Enterprise has been invaded by a creature capable of assuming any form with the capacity to paralyze and draw the life from any one of us. She's not magical.
All right, you got our money. Quiet. Thank you. Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it. Thank you. So, as Greg mentioned, George started with the Comic-Con way, way back in the beginning. And of this group, you might have noticed I'm the youngest. So, I actually, my memories in the beginning at Comic-Con are probably very different than the rest of this group, because George was just this fascinating, absolutely fascinating character to me. And it wasn't until I got older that I felt comfortable actually getting to know him on a personal level. I would sit by the pool at 3 a.m. And these, again, this will never happen. It never happened. In the Comic-Con future history, because it was so unique at the El Cortez, the things we got away with would be so illegal today. So
very illegal then.
Very illegal then. So sitting with people like Sergio Gonis, Jack Kirby, and George by the pool when I'm 14 years old at 3 in the morning, and listening to them talk, I could have stayed there forever. I mean, they would get into the most esoteric conversations about things, and I would just be blown away as a kid. It was absolutely amazing to me. And when I got older, I got to get into the con at a different level as an adult and spend more time with George and get to know him, you know, be much closer to him than as a teenager. So as time went on, I was able to, fortunately, and I thank Greg for this, for putting things together, I was able to host some parties at my house. And one of the stories that I'm going to tell is when George came one time, he was sitting, there were two things that happened that night that were just amazing to me. One, he's sitting there in my chair in my movie room, and I walked over and took the DVD of Logan Run. I said, George, do you mind signing this? I just took it off my shelf. And he's, oh, and he looked it over. He thought it was, you know, really cool to see the DVD. And a little later, we started talking, and somehow we got into talking about the pilot, because they had two different pilot episodes. It was like they made some changes from the original pilot episode of Twilight Zone that was shown. So somehow we got into a conversation about that. I said, well, you know, I've got the DVD upstairs. Go grab it. So I put it in. We were going to look at that because they had both versions on, but we never got that far. Because when the menu came up, the first thing George saw was it said Emmy Awards. He goes, what's that? What's that? I want to see that.
So we went ahead and we clicked on it and we brought it up, and it was Rod Sterling. I think it's at 3 different Emmy Awards. And he's going up and accepting for the Writing Award. And he mentions George. So on my big screen TV, George is sitting there watching Rod Sterling go up and mention his name. And the look on his face was unforgettable. He was so happy. He was just absolutely so happy. Both to see Rod again like that, and then to hear Rod mention him, he just was exuberant. The other story that I will always remember happened not that long ago, actually. It was a few years back when Stan Lee and Cassandra Peterson, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, acquired Kamikaze. It was right after they acquired it. We went up to L.A. I picked up George at his house with William Clausen back here and Greg, and we went up to give an award to Stan Lee. And George was just so excited about the whole thing. He just couldn't wait to get there. And he was having a blast. We were up there waiting, and it was a whole bunch of stuff that happened.
You forgot something.
What's that?
George was dressed normal. No hat. Nice slack.
Oh, yeah.
Shiny, black leather.
I didn't recognize him. I don't know who he was.
For Stan Lee. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, he was just absolutely, over the top. He did the special inscription on this book to give him and everything. That's Twilight Zone book. So we were sitting there, and the most random, I mean, only at conventions can something like this happen. The most random thing in the world happened. This young man comes by, and his entire arm, and I have video and pictures of this. It's just amazing to see. Yeah, William knows what I'm talking about. I mean, it was the most bizarre fluke of all time. This man should happen to walk by George, and George looks, and he stops him. His entire arm was black and white of pictures of Twilight Zone. He had Bill Mummy, he had the clock, he had all this up and down his arm. And it was just astounding. And George is holding his arm looking at it. I took the picture, and he's holding his arm looking at it. And the look on his face, again, he just can't believe what he's seeing. I mean, just the randomness at that moment of that happening. But he to me, was just like this gentleman next to me. He was so much a part of this convention. The first year that, because his health, it wasn't so much his health as he just got to a point a few years back where he just didn't want to deal with the crowds, unfortunately. I mean, it just became too difficult for him. So it was really hard going around the convention that year and not seeing George all over the place, because that's how it was year after year after year. It was always George, he'd be somewhere. I'd see him multiple places in one day. And we will miss him greatly. He was just an amazing man.
Thanks, Anthony. Those tattoos, wasn't there one of his episodes on the
Yes,
Twilight
Zone? Oh, no, absolutely.
And if
absolutely.
I remember, I think the guy just randomly sat down next to him.
I think
him
he had something. The can. He had the can from Kick the Can on his arm.
Gene, I'm sure you have a good story. You being the director of security back then, you must have busted George a couple of times.
George was a little fortunately, I never had to arrest George or do anything like that. But I do remember a couple of incidents. One was that he was... Is this thing on him?
Yeah, no. Hold it close.
Okay. There you go. Oh, I always hate these things. Anyway, George was setting up for an interview with... I can't remember her name. Acronym.
Wendy?
Wendy? Yeah. Wendy. So I came to be finding. Anyway, he was setting up an interview with her, and he was being very meticulous about where everything was, the lights, and it was unfortunately, that was the night of the masquerade, and he was on a masquerade table, and the crowd was getting angry outside and murmuring, threatening. Finally, Shil came in. And he says, what's happening here? And I said, well, George is setting up for an interview with Linda. He said, this thing is going to turn into a lot. We're going to have a revolution. So he opened the doors and everything pouring in. And poor George, the look on his face, he was devastated. I never heard what happened when he met Michelle later. I tried to avoid these little things. Anyway, the next kind of thing that I do remember, he spoke at the West Coast Comics Club in Orange County, and that's when we had a membership. And he came in to tell us, talk to us, and he was telling us about the sequel he planned for Logan's Run. And it was a wild, exciting thing. We were all sitting there trying to figure out what he was talking about. And something in space and all this, and somebody, he or it. And anyway, when he got through, we all applauded. And we were asking each other, what's he talking about? But George was, one thing he did tell us, though, that was rather interesting. He said, I used to be straight. He said, I wore the suit, the tie, had my hair cut and everything. And he says, that's the way I was. He says, now I'm different. I'm my own person. And I thought that was rather good, a good thing. And the person that could have told you more about George than anybody else was my wife, Mary. Because she knew Laura really well. They were all very good friends. And when Laura started coming to the convention, Mary never did find out why or what happened. But anyway, she did tell me one thing, and this is a revelation to all of you. Because she told me that George never touched drugs. And see, all of you are really shocked. Did sound like you're a good drug. But that's what she told me, that George never touched drugs. So see, we're all wrong.
Whatever you say.
Well, for certain definitions of touching.
I think he started smoking pot after 1970, if I remember right. He wouldn't drink any alcohol back then because he's part Native American. But he started drinking red wine, I think, in the 80s, maybe the 1990s. At an early Comic-Con in the 70s, Ken Kruger, one of the key co-founders, he would have these spaghetti dinners at his home in La Mesa Sunday nights after the convention. So George and I would go. And I drove back in my 73 Firebird, George, and the famous artist Phil Garris. And just like a Cheech and Chong movie, they stopped us at the Border Patrol. And the car is full of smoke, and me and Phil Garris are freaking out. And George is going to like kill us and say, hey, you crazy idiots, calm down. The guy comes over, looks at us, and George does Obi-Wan Kenobi. But this was the early 70s, and me and Phil were just freaking out. It was very funny. And now we got Floyd Norman, who in the 1970s came to the El Cortez. He's first generation Comic-Con, El Cortez alumni, incognito.
Well, you know, back in the old days, I didn't know, you know, we didn't know who writers were because we didn't see the photographs. We just saw their names on screen, on screen credit. And I would see this name often, George Clayton Johnson, and I didn't realize it was that same guy who came to the San Diego Comic-Con. But that's one of those things where you get those surprises like, oh, that's that guy whose work I really admire. Anyway, one of the things I remember back in the 60s, it was a very exciting time, you know, Star Trek came on the air, Twilight Zone came on the air, and George Clayton Johnson, of course, wrote the scripts for Twilight Zone, and I had the opportunity to meet with Rod Serling. He would come to our office. I mean, I was just a kid back then, and to have a guy like Rod Serling come and spend time with us was just, you know, kind of a really awesome thing. But anyway, one of the things that George said that really struck me, because I'm an animation filmmaker, you know, spent my career mainly at Disney. But George Clayton Johnson said, you know, I think animation is the perfect medium for science fiction and fantasy. Not necessarily feature-length films, but for, you know, more short-form content. And I thought that was so really cool that my medium, the medium that I embraced, would be so embraced by George Clayton Johnson that he thought it was the perfect thing for science fiction. So that was one of the things that I take away from my first meeting with George. And then spending time with him, you know, I don't know how many years it's been since El Cortez Hotel here to this huge convention center in San Diego, but George was always here. We would gather around him as he would talk and pontificate about whatever. And that was my experience, and it was a great experience. I've been really lucky to meet my heroes, my screenwriter heroes, like George Clayton Johnson, Ray Bradbury, Harlan Ellison. and of course Rod Serling and the Beatles to meet these guys and spend time with them. Such an inspiration for a young writer like myself, trying to learn how to write, you know, and to bring that, that mystery and magic to the Disney films. I learned so much from guys like George Clayton Johnson, Bradbury, Ellison, and others who were a major influence on me.
Very nice.
That's very cool.
When we started the Sheldorf Fan Club, Mike Tari, the late Richard Al Lawson, George Clayton Johnson, it was pretty much George's idea. Because we got to do a fan club to honor him. But I said, isn't that corny? He said, great, those people in the generations, when you were a kid in the 50s and 60s, fan club was your media, very important. George would just go crazy honoring people in fandom. He would tell Mike and Richard how important, you know, Comic-Con, your role, your purpose was. He would have this thing to motivate you, whatever you did in the past, its importance. I mean, fandom was everything to George in so many ways. To them, it was equal. I mean, he just loved Fred Patton, everybody. He would be in awe of them. Here's this famous writer going up to people, whether they're even like Craig Miller. Craig Miller produced a lot of really big science fiction conventions years ago. And he was a contributor to Comic-Con in the 70s as well. And you guys know what I'm saying. It's hard to pass this emotion on, but how he motivate you about your importance and what you did in the past, you know, stuff like that.
Anybody, go for it.
I just thought of something just kind of interesting going back to listening to George and the way, you know, he was, and it's kind of interesting. I was looking back here, this gentleman in the far back, his name is Mike Powery. He has a convention called Comic Fest, and I was at that first one, and I was in utter shock because I walked in the evening and I saw George, and he looked like he had been hit by a truck. I kid you not. Yeah, it was just all over. I was in utter shock. And I started talking to him, and what was interesting is George was telling me that I said, well, you know, Pat, why'd you come? You look like you need to be in a hospital. And he said that he wanted to come and support Comic Fest, but it also, part of what it was that made him want to come was the fact that it was an opportunity to come back to something that reminded him of how it was when we started Comic Con, when you had the opportunity to be able to go up to the artists and talk to them and spend time with them. And again, for this Comic Con, that's very hard to do. You stand in the line for, what, 3 hours, or you sleep overnight outside, you know, if you want to see one of the well-known guests. But that to me, again, just showed the kind of person George was. He made that effort, that concerted effort, at a time when most people wouldn't even think of leaving their house, because he wanted to go and support it, and he wanted to be able to feel what he felt back, you know, way in the 70s, when that kind of feeling of the fans and the guests mingling in just a smaller kind of convention existed. So that's just another memory that popped to mind.
George was very... George seemed to like everybody. There may be two or three people on the planet he didn't like, maybe, but...
He told me every one of them.
But, you know, he just seemed to like everyone. He would meet new people everywhere he went. And he was authentically interested in talking to them and learning about them. And he was always supportive of everyone and what they were doing. He was just very open and very giving in that way.
He would praise people in such a big way, endlessly, not to their face, but to their friends. The things he would say about Larry Niven and Jerry Cornell, and when Willie Ito and Floyd first came to Comics Fest a few years ago, he was all excited because he had met Willie several times in the early 70s at Comic-Con. But he was an amazing person in so many ways.
One of the things that always impressed me about George is he didn't go around self-promoting himself. You had to actually draw everything out of him. You know, like, aren't you the guy I saw in the box, the DVD that wrote that movie I really liked? Or didn't I see your name on one of these Twilight episodes? Or, you know, I mean, people would come up to him and he wouldn't be telling them his whole life history of everything. They had to draw it out, but he was always open to somebody coming up and asking them, how can I be a writer? How can I do this? Or, you know, I want to be like you, or I want to do something like... I never, in any of the times I was with George, heard him tell somebody, no, I'm not going to talk to you. No, he's truly genuine about wanting to know about what you did, how you were, you know, what kind of things you wanted to do. I mean, he actually listened, and then he asked questions about it too, so you knew he was listening to what you said, because he'd be asking, you know, things about, well, what about that? Or how did you like that? Or hey, did you see this? You know, and if you liked my things, did you see this? Because this is by so-and-so or somebody else, you know. So he wouldn't be afraid to also tell you the things he likes, but didn't promote himself.
I was there in the Frankenstein Cafe when, yeah, when George was in there with the messed up face and everything.
Yeah,
yeah. And one thing that I think I'm going to miss the most. Damn. Is the spirit of George. You would get the spirit of those times by hanging out with George and Forrest Ackerman and Ray Bradbury and Larry Niven and all these great guys who just sort of inhabited the time and the moment of Comic-Con back then. And I think if you want to get a flavor of that now, you really got to go to Comic Fest. If you really want to know what it was like back in the day when you could hobnob with your heroes, you know, when you want to, I think Comic Fest now inhabits the spirit.
Yeah, 2 years ago, Clayton, William, and I, and George were walking around downtown, and we were walking miles and miles in the heat. And if you see the 2010, the pictures of the Shelburne tribute panel, George and I are like sunburned orange. I mean, we look more orange than Trump. And he goes, we must have walked 10 miles. And at Comics Fest, he loved it. You know, he'd bump into everybody. It'd be so cool.
Comic Fest is great. This is great too. But I'm trying to find a contribution here. On one of those rides I took with George, we were talking about Logan's Run. And I read the book, and somebody was saying, if you have a chance to read the book, it should come out again. I believe they're going to remake the movie, and they may re-release the original novel. And I bought it off of Amazon, because we would have lunch with George every couple of months. We'd organize an occasion in Burbank, and people from around the area would come. And there was one lunch when like 60 people came. Some guy brought the car from the Back to the Future.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was awesome.
There were so many people there. And George made a point, after lunch was served, everybody was kind of into their meal. I had lunch with Wendy, all the people at my table, for 90% of the time. George came by at every table and sat down and chatted with everybody there for a few minutes and said pleasantries and got the news. He went to the next table. And he was very dutiful about that. And again, under the table about it. Well, story I wanted to share about his writing. Maybe you guys don't know this. I've been to 2 or 3 tributes for George already, and this hasn't come out yet, so I'll share it with you now. In the novel, Logan's Run, there are many good scenes and descriptions about the future. Chapter 1 is really good to talk about the vision of the future, and then it gets into the plot of Logan and Jessica and what happens to them. But Chapter 1 really sets up the future. And the introduction to Chapter 1 is a 2-page list of all the influences and things that William Nolan and George liked, the things that inspired them to write this book. And it's a fun list to read. I recommend it to you. We'll get it on the website if it's not up there already. But in the story, Logan's Run, you guys know the premise of it. When your palm has a jewel in it and the jewel turns a certain color, your time is up. And when your time is up, the way that you die, when they kill you, is described pretty well in the novel, but it doesn't appear in the movie. It's not in the movie Logan's Run. It's in another movie. The death scene for somebody in Logan's Run is in the movie Soylent Green. Starring Charlton Heston, made by Warner Brothers Studios. Okay? And it's in the middle of the movie. And I won't ruin the story for anybody, but Edgar G. Robinson is a character in this movie, and he has a death scene in the movie. And it's a very kind of heartwarming death scene. And his time is up, and he's got to show up at the center, and he gets a drug. And he's showing a movie on a big screen with all kinds of emotional sensations that the film brings out in you. And he's riding this tide of emotional highs. That was his vision of death in the story, Logan's Run, that was interpreted on film in the movie Soylent Green. And I asked him about that. And he said, yeah, I wrote that. I wrote the novel. The studio bought the novel, and they did what they wanted to with it. And they took this chunk of the story from Logan's Run and put it in the movie Soylent Green. And I don't think his credit is on there.
You know,
you don't have to do that.
That reminds me, George told me a story decades ago. When the Sugar novel was published, MGM bought the rights right away. And MGM had rights to so much stuff in their archive, they didn't know what they had. A couple years before the movie came out, MGM had William F. Nolan and George for the meeting, and they're trying to negotiate to buy rights to the movie. And George goes, what's the matter with you? You already have the rights, don't you remember?
Speaking of Logan Run, it reminded me also of when I was 20-something, I was talking with George one time, and he asked, I was telling him, I really enjoyed the movie for the most part, and he said, well, you know, how many times have you seen it? I said, oh, I actually went back and saw it like 3 times in the movie theater. And he said, well, boy, you must really like the movie. And I said, well, it was a trade-off. I said, I didn't like Box, and the Box was pretty good. That was kind of stupid. I said, but yeah, sure, Fawcett. And he just laughed. That was really fun.
George would always give me advice, great counsel, like the late Richard Alf. I would never, ever, ever think of asking him for girlfriend advice. That'd be too much respect. But a few years ago, I was seeing this girl that George and I both knew for like 30 years. So I mentioned and asked him a few times, and then he said stuff. I had a revelation, it blew my mind, and everything he told me, just like, you know, I had a transformation. I totally freaked out. But I can't remember anything he told me.
What were you doing then?
When George, you know,
they were wrong about who was into the drugs.
Yeah.
When George had memory issues, he said, George, you're not having a senior moment, just blame the cannabis. But a few years ago, he said, Greg, this is my final years. I want to see as many friends and fans as possible. So when Clayton mentioned the Kroll Cafe with the DeLorean, in the back patio, George was dancing. People got pictures of him. So Bob Sawyer from Canada, the big science fiction author, was coming. And I said, Bob, are you going to be in town for the Writers of the Future Awards? Do you have time to stop by and see him? He was there. And years ago, Bob saved a voicemail message that George put on his phone. Then, when Bob came back again, he goes, Greg, we're going to have a luncheon at Big Jim's. I'm taking you out and George. Is it okay to bring a friend? I go, who? David Gerald. I go, what? So, we're at Big Jim's. David Gerald walks in with this giant smile. He hadn't seen George in a few years. And he goes, God, George, they had your episode to air first. And then George and David were talking about all the inside Star Trek stuff from the 1960s. And me and Bob Sawyer were just freaking out. The whole luncheon. I mean, when George would see an old friend like this, it was like family, you know. And I took a few pictures, they're on Facebook. But to see David and George's smile, how big and wide it would be. And George said something else that Clayton reminded me of. George would go, what the hell's the matter with these people that charge for autographs? They're killing their career. So George knew a lot about marketing and media. When I did my monthly Comic-Con with my comic book partner, the late John Janevich, I had a form to fill out, what are your interests, science fiction, fantasy. George would make a big circle and in it would write all media. And that was like 1973, that term. And I saved that. I still have that document.
Why don't we take audience questions of your stories?
So we're going to have a little Q&A and interaction with the audience. And Ed, go for it.
Does anybody recall the conversations with Ed where he discussed his experiences with Gene Roddenberry during the Star Trek film?
He loved the Mantrap episode. He sold, they bought Rockabye Baby or Die, but then Gene Kuhn came on, and with him and Gene, they didn't do the episode. And so I was wondering what happened in this episode. I bought a copy of it, the story treatment. I found out that Filmation got it. Filmation was going to do it, but the Filmation animated series got canceled. So I bought it online for $4, Rockabye Baby or Die, which they had bought. And Next Gen almost did something like that. But George had an amazing story. When they bought Kick the Can, he didn't care for the Kick the Can what Spielberg did with it. He said Spielberg didn't want to meet him. But he said that was making the most income, the residuals from the Twilight Zone DVD. So they didn't tell him it was a director's movie. So there was a Writers Guild arbitration. Since CBS gave the rights to the writers back, I think he said they only had to pay him like $7,000. But since they lied, and they didn't say it's a director's movie with all these little episodes in it, he ended up making a lot more money, like triple. He loved every episode he did originally. He loved Mantrap. He liked the Logan's Run movie a lot, even though it wasn't exactly like the book. But the reason I mentioned Demon God so much from Kung Fu, it was the first flash forward in episodic television where instead of having the flashbacks, they made the past present tense. George met David a couple times. I tried to get George the last few years to meet Calista Carradine, his daughter, because it was the first thing he directed. But I have here Sifu, master Kung Fu artist, martial artist, Rob Moses. Rob Moses trained David Carradine for decades. He was the Kung Fu coordinator on The Legend Continues. He even worked on the TV movie with David Carradine and Brandon Lee. So we have somebody stand up, Rob. So George loved the Demon God episode so much and all the actors, and he just blew them away. It was David Carradine's first time directing.
That episode, The Demon God, is on the third season of Kung Fu DVD collection. It's the third time that happened. It's a very good episode, but it's not characteristic of the other episodes. It's different, and it's a kind of internal struggle that the character has, which involves flashbacks and the flash-forward thing.
Just remind me real quick, George talked about this, and it popped back in my head. So when he did the episode Nothing in the Dark, the Twilight Zone episode with Robert Redford, he was there on the set when they filmed it. And he was telling me, there's some stories he was telling about, they have, in the episode, you'll see a clock on the wall next to the bed that he's in. And he said that the prop guy gave that to him when they were done filming. And he was so pleased that the guy was nice enough to give that to him from the set. But he also told a story about he met Robert Redford again many years later when he was doing Barefoot in the Park on Broadway with Jane Fonda. And he said that they went up to a bar at the top of some building, and they spent a couple hours and had a wonderful time talking. And it was just bizarre that stuck in my mind, because they're on YouTube just from a couple years ago. There's just it's like a minute and 19 seconds at a film festival that Robert Redford was at, where they asked him about that episode, and he said, he mentions the writer being Rod Serling in that short moment. He forgot that George wrote it, even though obviously he spent time with him, but he also said that he was sent an award. Robert Redford in that commentary says that he was sent an award for that being the most watched Twilight Zone episode ever. So I thought that was interesting. I, George, would have been very proud of that.
Thanks, Anthony. In the audience, we have Barry Short. Correct me, Barry, if I'm wrong. Former Vice President of
Comic... My name is Barry Short.
Okay, good. Yes. Former Vice President of Comic-Con, former Board of Director, correct?
All those things.
You're partially responsible for Giant Comic-Con, right?
For which?
Giant Comic-Con.
No.
This is Giant...
This?
Giant Comic-Con.
Yeah.
And WonderCon is Comic-Con Light, and ComicSess is Comic-Con Ultralight, right?
That's correct.
So what is your interaction with George in the early Comic-Cons?
The same as everyone else's, which is George was everywhere at them. Anytime that there was a chance for George to talk to anyone, he started talking. He was just everywhere. And I think that openness that he had, that everybody up here has talked about, is exactly the original spirit of Comic-Con. You know, it didn't matter who you were. We were all fans. And as fans, we were all equals. You know, no matter whether it was George, whether it was any number of the other people that we've mentioned, whether it was Floyd showing up. We didn't know who Floyd was at that time. But, you know, and now we know, oh, who was this guy who was walking among us? And it was just person after person that was like that. And I think that's why we all look back on those times so incredibly fondly, that there was a common bond among everyone who was at those conventions. And I think George really exemplified that in the sense that George was the biggest fan in the room.
True.
Well, that list of tributes at the beginning of Logan's run will make that point very clear. When you see things you like, I mean, it goes from the Odyssey to Papa. I mean, it's a range of things that influence him. And then all the things we have at Comic-Con, the range of things we have at Comic-Con. What I was going to say about his writing, one thing he also shared about writing a script, there's books of his Twilight Zone scripts that have been published, collected some of them. And he said he put work into the stage directions, not just the dialogue, the things that you would see on the screen, the concept of the story and all that, but he would make the lighting guy's job interesting by working him into the light pan sensuously across. Sensuously. There's something in there for everybody on the team that was making the episode to for them to do a good job, to tell his story, you know, as well, to get the whole team. We do a lot of team building in the school district because there's lots of different competing interests, but they all come together to serve the students. And, you know, that happens naturally when that's the goal. And that was the same with this episode. He's trying to construct it to make it work on every level that he could affect. Do you guys remember that thing, the deck of cards?
Yeah, oh, that's
right.
Right? Yeah, George.
He did a whole panel on that back in the 70s and explained his method, and everybody probably forgot about it. So
yeah, George would create a deck of cards, Jessica Wren and others, to explain a whole plot line for a movie or book or whatever.
Dr. Curry, he just reshuffle it and create another one every time.
Exactly. And William, you're one of the few people here that had a professional relation with George. You guys did a comic book and something else together, didn't you?
I did an illustration. I mean, he wrote the intro to my comic book series. But then he, passed me over to William F. Nolan, and I'm working with him now.
A few years ago, after Shell died, I can't remember the term, but in the Jewish tradition, it's not called the wake, but I can't remember the name.
Yeah.
We had it in Hollywood with Shell's family, and George came. And the whole time we were eating, Mike Amron was next to George on his computer tablet. And what, was it under an hour? He drew a perfect illustration of George on the computer. And we just all went crazy. We just thought he was, you know, messing around with his tablet. We weren't sure what he was doing, but it was brilliant. George loved it when people would draw him and illustrate him and do characters, extra caricatures, all that kind of stuff.
and we have Ramon doing cosplay George. All of this stuff, you know, George loved it. But one of the most unusual things he said, when we got reunited with Richard Elf and we started the Schellendorf Club, George said, "Greg, don't tell anybody this." I go, what is it? "There's something with Richard. I think you're going to be gone in 3 or 4 years. What are you talking about? It's like, you're like a dog that smells cancer or something." And he was right. He knew something was with Richard. And Richard died of pancreatic cancer in 2011. And the doctor said he must stay at it for like 3 or 4 years. But every time we got reunited, we all were trying to bring up memories, you know, from the El Cortezers. And we're going back and forth, back and forth. And we were having a great time.
The El Cortez years, somebody asked, 1978, I think, was the last year we were there. And if my math is right, that's coming up on our 40th anniversary of not being there anymore. I'm just saying, you know, it has that reputation to it, which is deserved, but still, you know, everybody's making memories everywhere they go. In fact, right now downstairs, Famous Monsters booth, the current issue of Famous Monsters has George Clayton Johnson in it. I know the cover has a bunch of different stuff on it, but there's a small article in there about Logan's Run and remembering the movie and some of the sequel plans for the movie. And there's a small cartoon that their staff artist did of George, you know, in his, you know, contemporary attire there. And they did a little tribute to him surrounded by some cast members from his episodes. You know, there was no text about him in the article, but they put the cartoon in there. So, you know, hats off to them.
When George was injured at Comic-Sans, I think he fell down or what. He had just gotten new glasses, and I'm not sure if they were bifocals. But when I had got new bifocals, I was working in Vegas. I'm the deputy inspection video technical director. I fell down twice down a bunch of stairs. Mike, I'm sure you have a lot of good stories from here. You were hanging out with us for years on all the events in that Comics Fest. We got the son of Aquaman in the back. Huh? The traitor Aquaman. You got anything you mentioned about George?
No, I didn't know George that well. A few times I met him, he was in the Brothers.
Do any of you remember the 50th fandom reunion?
Yeah.
Get together at Comic-Con in 2012?
This is last visit.
There's a lot of great group pictures of all of us together with Barry Short, George, William, Dr. Juan Camacho. You took a lot of those, didn't you? Sent them to me. Yeah, great.
And I have George.
There you go.
50th, right here.
Yeah.
Mark?
Waiting to buy. Actually, he's wearing the button. George is wearing the button I gave him. He joined us at Chicken Pie Shop for my birthday lunch.
Yeah.
He came and he saw the button I got as a present on it. It's this yellow button on it. It says, "I've damn near survived everything." And he was immediately entranced with it. So he said, "You know, George, here, you have it." And then I could see all these pictures after that, him walking around with that button on all these different jackets. Because he had damn near survived everything. So I think the crowd's on the floor. And he did have a special relationship, I think, with the El Cortez.
Oh, yeah.
Because he seemed to know, like a lot of us kids at the time, every one of the path screws, the underground places where you could get from one place to another, places you could hang out, you know, where the people were. Because you'd be somewhere, and you'd never see him coming. And then he'd suddenly be there. Like, he'd grab the pool, he'd suddenly come through the service doors from the back kitchen. I mean, he just knew the hotel really well.
Yeah, he said it was the greatest time of his life in many ways. When he started coming to Comic-Con, he said career-wise and financially, things were rough. And when they hosted him, hotel, and membership, and meeting people, he said it was really a boon to his career. It really, really helped. Mark, you knew him pretty well.
Yeah, my brother Charles Holliday did it with George, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. And my brother made a point to make friends all these things since he was in office. And my brother introduced me to him in the early 90s. And I'm like, oh, it's great. And got to hang out with George. And one day we were doing a, you know that book, that small little convention they do up in L.A., where, you know, a lot of the big science fiction writers do, and they were just not very great people.
You mean LostCon, or the month was that?
A little tiny book expo.
The one in Glendale, yeah.
Yeah, so I went up to that, and wow, like here you meet Ray Bradbury, there's a huge line, you can see him, right? But up there, they're like, you know, 15 people in line, so you get Ray Bradbury stuff. So I met George there, and was talking to him, he's like, hey, you want to go to dinner? And I'm like, okay, so I went to dinner with George and Bill Nolan and my brother and Ray Bradbury. I'm like, oh my God, I'm having dinner with Ray Bradbury, my favorite writer. This is cool. And that was kind of cool. And yeah, George is pretty cool. He's when you talk, my first panel, I've been running panels at Comic-Con since 2007. And my first panel had Bill Nolan, George Clinton Johnson, and Dave Gerald, and Walter Koenig, and John Truby, and afterwards we went out to after dinner, and one of my favorite Star Trek actors was Walter Koenig. I'm like, wow, that did much Walter Koenig, this is cool. But I'm sitting next to George, and I'm ignoring Walter Koenig because I'm talking to George, because, you know, the writers are always the interesting people to talk to, and when you talk to George, your imagination just does this, and I had two ideas for two different stories, and talking to George, I put them together and I came out with my first book. Just talking to George, like, stimulated my ideas. And George is awesome. He had writing techniques. I've read, like, every book there is on writing, and their techniques that I've never heard of, George had, like, used the seven deadly sins as an idea to start a story idea. Yeah, he's full of ideas. Great person to talk to.
George,
nicest people I've ever met.
George told me several times the only organizations that he loved and respected and he was a member of was the Writers Guild of America and the Shelter Fan Club. Every time we got a new member, and at first it was free, I'd say Steve Jeppy is a member now. Roy Thomas. And then when I told him Will Lund, he had all these stories about Will from the 70s. And we were trying to get him together, but we never did, right, Will? Did you ever get to see George before he passed?
Yeah. We had a gathering up in the Los Angeles area.
Burbank, yeah. We went up to Burbank. We saw him, yeah. Do you remember that? Yeah, you were there, right? Yeah, you were there.
When I moved back down to San Diego, taking care of my mom, the first thing I went to was something that Mike... George was doing. Was on the Golf for your Icarus writing or whatever.
Yeah, with Ray. Yeah, he got nominated for Best Short. Yeah.
And so that was the first time I had seen George in years because I'd been in various other states over the years and just seeing him coming on over the years.
George never owned a cell phone and he got an answering machine very late, so you would think. You know, he's not really good with technology specifically. So one day I'm showing pictures on my iPhone, everybody, and I hand it to George, and people go, "What, George?" And then he starts expanding. He knows how to work the iPhone. So a few years ago, at a get-together at the Glendale Bookshop, Ray Bradbury and George started speaking,
damn it, the internet, cell phones, all this stuff, people aren't, you know. And I said, it's kind of your fault. You guys are science fiction authors. And the first time in my life, I kind of like goaded them both as a joke. And they had these weird looks on their faces and it's frowned, and they started cracking up.
There was one time when Mark and I and George were all together. We went to this, I invited George to, he was incredibly gracious. And I invited him to a seminar of writers at Universal Studios. And so the seminar, what was the name of that thing? The Writers?
Scriptwriters Network.
Scriptwriters Network, yeah. So we're at the Scriptwriters Network, and we're on the Universal backlot, you know. And it's all been over, and George has been, you know, pontificating and spreading wisdom through this thing, you know, and he kind of like took over the whole thing.
The panel's on YouTube. You can find it.
Oh, yeah, the panel's on YouTube. You can still see it, yeah. And so there were all these great writers on that panel. And afterwards, we're all in the feeling this glow, and we're going to go to that deli on Ventura Boulevard. Yeah, that one. Yeah, all the head writers go there and everything. So we're on the lot, you know, and the tram is coming, okay? And I turn to George, I turn to everybody and says, guys, just go along with me on this. Just go along with me on this. So roll down the windows. So now we're in this SUV, and we're cruising past the tram on the Universal lot, and I start yelling at the driver. You know, I start going, dude, I paid you $1 million for that script. Why didn't you deliver it on time? I'm going to make sure that you never work in this business again. And the people in the tram are going, click, 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 click. And George is busting up. You know, we're all laughing and everything. And I say, oh, that was great. Here comes another tram. Let's do it again. Let's do it again. So we set this thing up, and I'm really going for it. I'm going to make sure that you never work. And my buddy was driving the vehicle. You know, he's really playing with it. And George, you know. And so we get past the second tram, and we go, oh, man, that was great. And we go to the deli, and the girl who, I guess, coordinated this whole thing, she arrives late at the deli. And she goes, guys, I'm really sorry that I'm late for this, but as I was coming in, this tram driver was going to make apologies for this terrible episode that they had seen where this guy was yelling at a writer and talking about firing him and everything. The people were all upset, and the driver was going, I'm sorry, folks, but you know, these Hollywood types, they're really serious about their projects, and there's a lot of money involved. And then I realized, oh my God, they're talking about us. That all these people were, and it was a wonderful moment with George. It was a wonderful moment with Martin. We did, but he was, he really just kind of, we had writers that from there, from, but the guy who wrote
Mark,
Cowboys and Aliens, and that other kind of, what was that kind of gladiator movie thing that, well, it was a lot of contemporary writers, but when George opened his mouth, you could hear a pin drop.
E.F. Hutton listens.
Pardon?
E.F. Hutton listens.
Yeah, exactly. And it was wonderful. And it was so much, he was in the mood and playing his role for the joke that we played, you know. That's one of my favorite George Clooney.
Actually, one of the questions he got from the audience was told me about, you know, special effects and how important they are in the industry. And he's like, none of that matters. It's all about the story. And if you have a story, you can just put it in just an empty room, and the audience will imagine it, and they'll go along with the story. The story shouldn't matter.
One story I remember about George. Several years ago, there was an AfterCon party with Matt Lorenz, and George was there, and he was introduced to a couple of very young kids that wanted to become writers. And so he sat down with them and basically taught them. And if you remember how, whenever George spoke, he had a certain pace, the way he delivered his words, and he would carefully think about every single word. He was like a Zen master. And there were these two kids with their eyes bugging out and jaws wide open to be sitting there in front of this guy listening to him and learning. And it went on for about an hour. It was an amazing sight.
Well, right after George, Jackie Estrada told me the story, right after George had met Kirby, they were talking for a long time. And when George got done,
he told Jackie Estrada, oh my God, everything he said blew my mind. George was totally freaked out after his first conversation with Jack Kirby. Anybody have
anybody
any questions?
Things to say? Isn't everybody?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a quick note to if you're interested in really getting to know George and you know his thought process about Star Trek and what he did with Twilight Zone, after George passed, I tried to slowly, when I have time, catch episodes off the Blu-rays. And there's a lot of commentary that George does on the Blu-rays. It's really interesting because there's some episodes where the man that interviewed him, named Mark Scott Siegfried, interviewed him back in 78. Then the Blu-rays, for the Blu-ray edition, they went back and they interviewed him in 2011. So you know, on the same extras on an episode, you'll get to hear him back in 78 talking about things like even Comic-Con, and then he'll talk about, you know, different things in 2011. So I highly recommend, and there's great commentaries on the Blu-rays by Len Wein, Mark Wolfman, just fantastic commentaries from a lot of the well-known comic artists too.
Dr. Bill Wilson's here in the audience. You're a former Comic-Con committee member and one of the co-creators of the Comic-Con trade show in the 1980s, is that correct?
That's true. I only met George one time, and that was one of the early El Cortez shows. It was the year that Network came out, and people were hanging out the window. We had a whole bunch of guys up in Shills, some hospitality shows. Somebody had filled the bathtub with beer, and, like they do in the science fiction convention. We came out of science fiction convention. And I'm sitting there, and I had a drink, and George sits down and starts chatting about I don't remember what. And he felt that anybody that wanted to come should be able to come.
Since you mentioned Network, I don't remember who brought it, but that was the year somebody brought Network to us and just sort of, I think they dropped it off in an unlabeled envelope outside the door of the video room. So we showed it on the live contract. We didn't think we had all that many people actually watching. So we got on and stopped it at the point where he's yelling and started chanting on there, telling people, open the windows in the hotel, stick your head out of the hotel, and start yelling, if Magic's telling them, I'm not going to take it. And then we start finding out the police are coming because people are yelling and screaming out the window of this hotel. But I'm mad as hell I'm not going to take them when they don't understand what's going on.
The movie was popular. Yeah, it was a big cliche. Everybody opens the window because they see the guy doing it on TV. They're supposed to run to the window and yell. We're mad as hell. It's like a political rally. Like a name of political figure. Anyway, we changed it up to make it we're happy as hell. And we want some more. That's the thing, see? So we get ready to go to the windows and yell that out for like 15 minutes. Now that's what you do, because it was closed circuit TV and there was nothing like it.
Yeah, but we didn't think anybody was
watching. Mr. Technology here decided to hook it up and get it running.
I remember, was Tim Leary at the 1978 conference?
Well, the incident that I'm talking about was earlier than that. Yes,
it was like 1976.
He was there when we were at the Golden Hall, right? At the Plaza.
At the Civic Center, over at the Civic Center.
I remember at the El Cortez, I had a dealer's table next to Timothy Leary's. But he was gone a lot, and his wife was there a lot. And I got pictures of his wife I took. And the U.S. Marshals came every day to check on him because he just got out of prison. And they were in suits. And I teased them, what are you doing here? You guys don't fit in. And best of my recollection, in the TV room, George and Tim Leary were smoking pot, and Scott recorded it on video. I remember walking in. It was 1970s. Any more questions? Because we only have a few minutes. Any more questions?
Or stories?
Or stories?
Stories?
Pardon? Scott's going to get it when he...
Yeah, we got it.
Yeah, we got it.
Because we're people doing things that I don't think we want to.
I remember when people would say to George, you got to think outside of the box. He said, you're crazy. You have to put the box sideways. You'd always want to be original and creative with words, terms, you name it.
Well, we can wrap it up if everybody's done.
Wait, he's got over here.
Lady back here.
Go ahead. The lady?
Best word of advice that he gave you.
Pardon?
What's the best, like, single word of advice that he gave you?
Well, you got to live your dreams. You know, be futuristic. But the best thing I think George is respect and honoring people. His prolific voice, I said, he told me a few years ago, because great, there's a lot of writers that are scared of public speaking. I think getting your point across, a few years ago when they were going to again do the Logan's Run movie and they called him in, some big producer, I don't know who the ship with, and they asked George to write something on spec. And he's such a professional, you know, he was nice, but you know, it's insulting. You know, big studio is going to go to him. I don't want him to write something for free. He was never about money. Carl Masick, before he died, did a book with George. Right before Carl died, he gave George all the rights for the books to keep him, that other Twilight film book, not the Mark Zecree one. George always passes it out and gives it away for free. And I thought, you know, we both knew Carl for 30, 40 years. And I think a year or two before he died, he said, George, I want you to have this. Here's where you go get them printed and stuff. It's all yours. I don't need it no more. And I thought that was pretty kind. We had so many friends that we were honoring before they died and while they were ill. And it never stopped because he'd always point out to these people how important they are in our lives, fandom, Comic-Con's history, legacy, whatever.
Okay, well, thanks everybody for coming.